So the first one is Sravanam, listening or hearing, both are correct. And Kirtana means singing glories of the Lord or hymning, singing hymns. And third one is Smaranam, remembering. Fourth one is Padasevanam, service. Fifth one is, of course, I have not changed the numbers, you know.
This is a remote here. Yes. This is five.
So, Smaranam is remembering, and Padasevanam is service, Archanam means worship, Vandanam is prostration, bowing down to the Lord, Dasyam is servitude, Sakhyam is comradeship, Atmanivedanam is total surrender to the Lord. These are the nine parts. The sloka is there, if you want I can write here. Sloka is this: Sravanam Kirtanam Vishnoho Smaranam Padasevanam Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakhyam, Atmanivedanam. Two lines. Then, Idhi Pumsa Appida Vishnu Bhaktisce Navalakshana Kriyade Bhagavadi Adha Tan Manne Adhidam Uttamam. Lord Krishna is a central figure. So, Prahlada says, those who have got this Navavidha Bhakti, him I consider to be a well-educated, civilized, well-informed person. Tat tam adhidam manni. Him I consider to be well-educated. This is the idea behind. So, now this Prahlada himself gives a very, very graphic definition, description of bhakti. He says, Ya prithihi avivekanam vishayeshu anapayini sa tvam anusmarada same kradayat ma apasarpadu. This is the Sanskrit verse. Ya prithihi avivekanam vishayeshu anapayini. Aviveka means those who don't have a proper power of discerning. I mean, those who don't have viveka, maturity, they are so much attached to worldly pleasures. Normally, as I said, you know, mind is being dragged by the five senses of perception towards the fleeting objects of worldly enjoyment. So generally, worldly minded people are so much attached to worldly pleasures. That's the preeti. Let me have that attachment towards you. That is Prahlada says. So, I remember you and let my senses be as attached to you as the senses and mind of worldly minded people are attached to objects of pleasure. So what exactly a devotee does, he is just giving a reorientation to his senses. That's why bhakti is supposed to be a very easy path. You find many of the great devotees, Tulsidas, and there is one great author, Narayaniya, it's called Narayana Bhatta. Many, even Valmiki, the author of Ramayana, many of them had questionable backgrounds. Some sudden shock in their life. Sometimes scolding by their wife, as in the case of Tulsidas. And you know, in the case of Valmiki, he was a robber. He was, his profession was ambushing, waylaying poor people walking through the lonely paths. So once it so happened that he tried to ambush a group of sages. So they asked him, all right, you want to rob us of our belongings, But do you know what will happen to you as a result of your evil actions? They asked him, for whom are you doing all these evil things, robbing people, killing people? They said, he said that we have to look after his wife, children and all the family relations. That was his profession. Oh, very good. Then you go and ask your relations, your children, your wife and other people, whether they will share the sufferings which will come as a consequence of your evil actions. He went and asked a simple man. They said, no, it's your duty to provide for us, to bring whatever we want. We don't know in what way you are acquiring your money, your all these necessary items. They did not perhaps know that he was a professional robber. That was an opening to him. His eyes were opened. Then they instructed him and he underwent a complete transformation in course of time. He became the great Valmiki sage, Rishi. So this happened to many great spiritual personalities. Sudden shock, sudden transformation. But this sudden transformation is not possible unless this person has got some spiritual background. Somewhere in the past, he must have accumulated some good karmas, some good tendencies and impressions. That suddenly come to the surface. All the professional robbers don't undergo transformation when they are jailed or when they are imprisoned. They become more hardened criminals. But there are some of these people who suddenly realize, well, that they have been doing something terribly wrong. So they have something against which they compare their present activities, and they suddenly become filled with repentance or remorse, and they undergo a complete transformation. So the idea is, Prahlada says that generally people are attracted towards worldly objects of pleasure. Let my mind also be attracted towards you, God, just as worldly minded people are attracted towards worldly pleasures. That is Prahlada. So, ya prithi avivekanam vishayeshu anapayini tuam anusmarataka sami hridayat ma apasarpatu. I am trying to remember you. Let this devotion, this memory never depart from my mind. Let it always remember in the depths of my heart. This is Prahlada's prayer. Now, here the question arises, why do all these things happen? Sometimes, you know, devotional philosophers have tried to analyze the growth of devotion in the light of free will, human effort, it's a Purusha Prayatna, Kripa. These two are very important factors in devotional life. Whether it is one's own effort or is it the grace of God? Now, Sri Ramakrishna had tried to resolve this problem. In fact, this contradiction, the apparent contradiction between self-effort and God's grace, cannot be resolved at a logical level. But the moment you start practicing a little devotion, you suddenly find this problem gets reconciled. You find that your so-called self-effort is also an expression of divine grace. As I said last time, a devotee whose spiritual progress is blocked by his obsession with worldly pleasures and worldly enjoyments will be helped by God, who removes all the obstacles from his path. Say, as I said in the last class, those who are obsessed with status, wealth and wisdom, see, yasya anugraham icchami tasya vittam hadamyaham. For those whose spiritual progress is blocked by obsession or attachment to wealth, God renders him or her poor, so that obstacle is removed from his path. those who are attached to worldly relationships, God gets him isolated. So that obstacle is removed. So if a devotee finds there are problems in her or his life, he should consider this as an act of grace on the part of God. So if he looks upon these setbacks or problems in life as a sign of God's grace, then his devotion also increases. That's why Gita gives a room for all types of devotees. Artho jignyasir arthaarthi jnani udara sarva evaiti. Lord Krishna says there are four types of devotees: artha jignyasu arthaarthi jnani, those who are sick, helpless, a terrible problem in life, they have knocked at many doors but without any success. Now for such people, what happens? They turn to God. So God has room for them also, because instead of going astray, in search of some other shelter, they have turned to God. So absolutely no problem. Their problems will be solved by God. But you can't say that they belong to the highest type of devotees. The highest type of devotees won't care even for solutions to their worldly problems. See, you find in Sri Ramakrishna's life, he fell sick, but he didn't pray for recovery. And in fact, he asked Swamiji, who was facing a terrible economic crisis in the later days of his pre-monastic life, after the passing away of his father. He informed Sri Ramakrishna about his problem. Sri Ramakrishna in a way was trying to test him, already go and pray to Divine Mother for finding a solution to your problems. But Swamiji could not pray for economic wealth or anything, any worldly help. Swamiji prayed for the highest devotion, for the highest knowledge. So there are highly exalted devotees who cannot bring their mind down to their worldly problems. But there are devotees who may be sick, who are facing problems in life. They can and they may, they should pray to God. They have a place in God's empire. God's doors are open to them also. So ato jignyasu, there are those who are interested. Does God really exist, or is just a myth? So jnadam iccha es jignyasa, just a desire to know, to unravel the mystery whether God exists or not. They also have a place in the world of devotees. So the artharthi, people who are economically poor, those who want some worldly help, instead of praying to ordinary people who may give you $100, why don't you pray to a billionaire who may give you $1 billion? So God is the greatest, is the repository of all wealth, so why don't you pray to God? And the jnani, those who have of the most exalted types of devotees, spiritual aspirants, they won't care for any worldly help. Now, according to the non-Advaitic schools of Vedanta, like Ramanujaya system, Vaivallabha and Ramanujaya systems, you know, they're inclined towards the Vaishnavite philosophical ideas. According to them, everyone can pray to God. Suppose an arthati, or somebody who is in need of worldly help, instead of taking to some foul means for solving their problem, they are turning to God. That certainly udaraha. Shankaracharya says udara means utkrishta chitta. They are noble-minded people. Because instead of turning towards undesirable channels. They are turning to God for help. So when they pray to God in all sincerity and earnestness, God listens to their prayers. God fulfills their prayers and their expectations. But of course, at that time, at this stage, they are praying with desire. It is not the highest type of devotion, but it is a mediocre type of devotion, because they are praying to God for some worldly results, for resolving their worldly problems. God listens to their prayers, fulfills their dreams and answers their problems, and gradually, when they become gratified as a result of a sense of gratitude towards God who has answered, who has listened to their prayers, they start praying to God without any desire. So at the beginning stage, they pray to God with desire. And when they feel that God has solved their problems, a poor man who prays to God for wealth becomes rich. Instead of becoming a bohemian, he thinks, well, God has answered my prayers. Now I must pray to God with greater intensity of devotion. In this way, he starts praying to God even without any desire. So he graduates, he evolves to the next stage of devotion. He becomes a higher devotee. As a result of a sense of gratitude, his bhakti becomes nishkama bhakti. In this way, he becomes a higher devotee. This is the Vaishnavite interpretation of devotion. Now, in this matter, as I said, you know, there is always this problem, this purusha prayatna, self-effort and grace. If everything is an act of grace, then there is no place for human effort. If everything is a result of human effort, then there is no place for the so-called divine grace. But according to philosophers of devotional philosophy, once you enter your spiritual world, the spiritual journey, enter the path leading to spiritual goal, when you actually start practicing spiritual sadhana, then you find even the human effort is within the jurisdiction of God's grace. So this contradiction is resolved the moment you actually start practicing spiritual sadhana. So reconciliation is possible only at the experience level. But then when we when you go to the next chapter, that is Pada Sevanam, that's what we are going to deal with now, then we understand this devotion is in fact the highest spiritual humanism. Devotion is not only a kind of individual spiritual journey, but it is also the highest type of spiritual humanism. That's why Swamiji, in one context in the practical Vedanta lecture, says, Swamiji says, human mind is the Taj Mahal of temples. Therefore, the greatest act of worship is the service done to the man living next door to you. So, the highest worship is this world, the service done to fellow human beings. There are people who take an opposite view. They try to individually achieve spiritual goals. I already quoted some of the verses from Bhagavata 11th Skandha, from the dialogue between the great sage Antariksha, one of the Navayogis, and the great king Nimi. As he said, you know, a great king, Nimi, was one day visited by 9 great sages. The king asked them many questions. How to do one's duty properly, how to worship God, how to develop spirit, devotion, and so on. And in response to the king's questions, one of the great sages explains 3 types of devotees. In a descending order, he describes 3 types of devotees. The first and the highest devotee is one who sees all human beings in God and who experiences the presence of the divine in all, in the, not only human beings, in the entire creation. So sarvabhudeshu ye pasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavati atmani esha bhagavadottamaha. So sarvabhudeshu yaha bhagavad bhavam pasyet, the one who sees God's presence, not just seeing but experiences the presence of the divine in all living beings, and the one who experiences the presence of all living beings in God, he is the highest devotee. Esha bhagavadottamaha means he is the highest devotee. Actually, this is nothing but the totality of all the 4 Mahavakyas put together. Aham Brahmasmi Tattvamasi, you know, put together. I am Brahman. Brahman is the, from the macro point of view, the reality perceived as the source, the sustaining principle, and the point of dissolution is Brahman. Yatova imani bhudani jayante yena jatani jivanti ye prayante visam visanti tad vijnyasasva tad brahma. You find it at the Upanishad. The supreme principle which is the source of everything, which is sustaining principle of everything, and which is the point of dissolution of everything. That is Brahman. And that Brahman, aham brahmasmi, and that same reality is yourself. Now, this is the highest Advaitic experience. The same Advaitic experience is the experience of a devotee who has reached the highest level of transcendental mystical experience. Some of you may be interested, you find if you compare the writings of Meister Eckhart and the devotional interpretation of Narada's Sattvasmin Parama Prema Rupa, means the highest devotion is of the nature of love of the supreme reality of God. You find the same Advaitic experience which was actually expounded in graphic detail by Shankaracharya 400 years before him, was again reproduced by Eckhart in the old German language. So when devotees or those who have followed the path of wisdom reach the experience level, you find they all speak the same language. They all speak, maybe the language may be different, but the content is the same. They speak the same, speak about the same experience, but the language, the vocabulary, the media they use may be different depending upon the cultural diversities of different devotional traditions. But then, yesterday I quoted this, there are devotees who have not reached the highest transcendental mystical experience. For them, they have to practice a proper discernment in their interaction and in their life and activities. So, Ishwareta Dadhineshu Baliseshu Nishutsucha Prema Maitri Kripa Ubeksha Yekarodi Samadhyamaka. So, they should have devotion to God, they should have a sense of comradeship towards the devotees of God, and they should have compassion towards those who are ignorant of God, and they should be totally indifferent towards those who criticize, who has enemies of God or enemies of spiritual culture. So the highest devotee is actually the practitioner of the highest universal spiritual humanism. So the highest devotion is nothing but a type of the highest spiritual universal humanism, because he looks upon entire creation as one spiritual family. Now, in the next verse, Antariksha, this great sage, speaks of those who are primitive in their outlook on spiritual life. Archayam eva haraye pujam cha saddhaye hade nacha tad bhakteshu cha nesu yek karodi sa prakritaha. Prakritaha means primitive, those who are just beginners. There are people, they will go to places of worship, they will be very rigid, very conservative, and in fact they will be extremely diligent in the ritualistic mechanical practice of devotional exercises. But the same rigidity they display in their attitude towards other fellow human beings. So they are primitive. So saddhayekade archayameva hariye pujam cha saddhayekade, those who do worship of God with great devotion. Worship of God could mean practice of formalistic religion, mechanical religion. You can find people who fast on sometime Ekadasi days. They will say, they will be fasting, and they will say, all these fellows are eating, see, I am fasting. What they need is they should first of all eat 4 square meals every day, and slowly after doing that for several years they should start fasting. Because real devotees won't look upon other people's practices with any kind of intolerance. That's why Krishna says, yukta ahara viharasya yukta cheshtasya karmasu yukta supna avabodhasya yugo bhavati dukha. So moderation in all activities, whether eating food, sleeping, in all kinds of activities, is very much essential for a devotee and also for a yogi. So any kind of intolerance is the antithesis of the enemy of devotional life. A devotee will be broad-minded. As I said, advesta sarvabhudana maitra karunayavacha. A devotee can never be fanatical. A devotee who is devoted to his God and hates all other people in the world, then what kind of God is you worshipping to? If God is merciful, God is compassionate, if God is the embodiment of all the noble, conceivable human qualities like compassion, mercy, humanism, etc., then the more devoted you become, the more intolerant you become towards your fellow human beings. It is not devotion to God, it may be devotion to something else. So here in the Bhagavata Purana there is a very famous statement in which this idea is put forward. One of the Navayogis who visited the great king Nimi says, sarva bhudeshu ye pasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavadottamaha. That is a statement here. The one who says the same reality everywhere, this is the highest spiritual evolution. And again there is also a famous statement attributed to Kapila. Aham sarveshu bhudeshu bhudatma avasthita sada tam avajnaya mam artyaha kurude archa vidambanam yomam sarveshu bhudeshu santam atmanam ishwaram hitva archam bhajade maudhyat bhasmanneva jihoti saha dushada parakaye mam manino bhinna darshinaha bhudeshu buddha vairasya namana shantim ruchyati. അഹം ഉച്ചാവചേ ദ്രവ്യേഹി ക്രിയതേ ഉത്പന്നയ അനഖി നൈവ തൃപ്യർച്ചിതോച്ചായം ഭൂതഗ്രാമാവമാനിനഹ. ഇറ്റ് സംതിങ് വെരി ഫേമസ് സ്റ്റേറ്റ്മെന്റ് ഇൻ ദി ഭാഗവത പുരാണ. ഫസ്റ്റ് ദ ലോർഡ് സേസ് ഐ അബൈഡ് ഐ ഡ്വൽ ഇൻ ഓൾ ബീയിങ്സ് ഇൻ ഓൾ നോട്ട് ഓൺലി ഹ്യൂമൻ ബീയിങ്സ് എൻറ്റയർ ക്രിയേഷൻ ആസ് ദി ഇന്നർമോസ്റ്റ് സെൽഫ്. അഹം സർവേഷു ഭൂതേഷു ഭൂതാത്മാ അവസ്ഥിത സദ. ഐ എം ഓൾവേസ് പ്രസന്റ് ആസ് ദ ഇന്നർമോസ്റ്റ് റിയാലിറ്റി ഓഫ് ഓൾ ബീയിങ്സ്. ഗീത സ്റ്റേസ് അഹമാത്മാ ഗുഡാകേശ സർവഭൂതാശി സ്ഥിത അഹമാദിശ്ച മധ്യം ച ഭൂതാനം അന്തയവച്ച. കൃഷ്ണ സീസ് ഐ എം പ്രസന്റ് സർവേഷാം ഭൂതാനം അന്ത. ഐ എം പ്രസന്റ് ആസ് ദ ഇന്നർമോസ്റ്റ് ഇമ്മനന്റ് പ്രിൻസിപ്പിൾ ഇൻ ഓൾ ബീയിങ്സ് ആൻഡ് ദ ബിഗിനിങ് ആൻഡ് ദ മിഡിൽ ആൻഡ് ദ എൻഡ് ഓഫ് എവ്രിതിങ് ഇൻ ദിസ് വേൾഡ്. സോ if you just worship me in an external symbol, any kind of mechanical worship, in image or a picture or it need not be an image or a picture, may be a symbol, a sentence, a statement, and you think, well, if I just mechanically utter a few prayers, my God is happy, then I can do whatever I want. It is only just a semblance of worship. It is not real worship. So the greatest worship of God is the service of living beings in whom that God is present as a living reality. Now here Kapila says, if one disregards me present in all beings and just practices mechanical worship of God, external practices, rituals, in any, it may be in any kind of religion, any kind of external rituals, then the Lord says that kind of external worship is absolutely ineffective. And there is a comparison given here. Hitvarcham bhajade maudhyat bhasmanneva juhoti saha. When you perform yajna, fire sacrifice, you have to offer ahuti in blazing fire. But suppose you put your ahuti, offer your ahuti in ashes, in a heap of ashes, that can't be called a yajna, that cannot be called a ritual. So to confine me to mere mechanical worship, to confine me as limited within the four walls of a place of worship and not to respect me present as the immanent principle in all living beings is as ridiculous as worship, as offering ahuti, offering things in dead ashes. So that is the statement of the Lord. So that is the relevance of Swamiji's statement. The human mind is the Taj Mahal of temples. The greatest act of worship is the act of service done to our fellow human beings. It doesn't mean that you should not worship God, or you should not go to places of pilgrimage, or you should not honor places of worship. You should, true, but you should not confine God's presence to mere places of worship. Spirituality goes beyond mechanical ritualism and formalistic worship. It should extend beyond the four walls of the boundary of religions. That's the difference between religion and spirituality. Spirituality is universal. Religion also, in its true sense, is spirituality. But very often it is misinterpreted as something limited to mere external rituals. So one should go beyond this. This is the universal humanism of devotion philosophy. In other words, a devotee will be a perfect practitioner of universal humanism. He looks upon entire creation, not only human beings, the whole creation as an expression of the reality. You should not mistake this as mere pantheism, because in pantheism you equate external nature to God. It is not even polytheism or monotheism. It goes beyond all this. It is the same as the highest idealism and monism. So when you interpret it in terms of universal humanism, we should not equate it with pantheism. What Kapila means here is that true devotee is a real universal humanist. He sees everywhere the presence of the divine principle. Now, any devotee who makes a clear-cut difference between worship and his worldly activities and lives purely an ego-centered life will be inimical to other beings and be thus persecuting me who resides in them. That's why. See, archayam eva hari pujam cha sadhiyekate. So, anyone who makes a clear-cut distinction and difference between the secular and spiritual, who thinks that, well, his spiritual life is confined to 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the evening, the rest is secular life, that devotee is only devotee of the most primitive type. The higher devotee has got only one life, that is spiritual life. So spiritual life, devotional life, is a 24 hours affair in your life. It is not just a set of rituals. Swamiji also, you know, Swamiji speaks of 4 levels of spiritual growth. He speaks of rituals, theology, philosophy and experience. At the most primitive level, it's the kindergarten of spiritual life. You perform rituals. And at the level of rituals, each devotee is different from each other devotee. Paths are diverse. Then beyond that you have mythology. Mythology is nothing but an attempt to justify some of the rituals. At the mythological level, perhaps there can be some similarity between different types of devotees. Third level is philosophy. At the philosophical level, perhaps there is some identity and similarity among different types of devotees. But still there will be no perfect harmony. But at the highest experience level, there will be perfect harmony and synthesis and unity, because experience is one. The transcendental, mystical, devotional experience is one in all religious and spiritual traditions, in all cultural traditions. So, at that level, you experience this, the highest spiritual humanism. That's what the importance of this particular statement. So he says, Dushada parakaye imam manino bhinna darshanaha bhudeshu baddha vairasya na manashanti mrityati. Those who distinguish between different human beings based on purely egocentric life, and those who disregard the presence of the reality, the Supreme Lord in all fellow beings, but confines his or her spiritual life to mere external rituals, they are only beginners. I am not at all pleased with such worship. That's a statement of the Lord himself. So, another statement is the Archado Archayetavat Isharam Mam Sukarmakrut yavanna veda sukriti sarabhudeshu avasthitam atmanascha parasyapi yakkarodi antarodaram tasya bhinnadrisho mrityu vidathe bhayamudbanam. So again the statement continues. So a person should of course worship me either in symbols or images, which means external rituals. One may go to a place of worship on a particular day and perform external rituals. There is nothing wrong in this. It is necessary because it is the beginning of spiritual life. See, you have to be very careful because there is a lot of scope for self-deception and hypocrisy in this. There are some people who will tell you, I'm intellectually quite elevated. I don't believe in religion. I don't believe in places of worship. But I accept that there's a spirit which is pervading everywhere. No, that is, actually it is an attempt to deceive oneself and deceive others. Now, if that person who says, who tells you that there's a spirit pervading everywhere, therefore I reject the parts of other devotees, then there is something wrong. But if he or she says, well, I believe in this, but I don't reject the different paths, the diverse paths followed by different types of devotees, different followers of different faith systems, then it is acceptable. So any kind of rigidity, fanaticism or intolerance is the very antithesis of devotion. The more you become devoted, the closer you move towards God, the more broad-minded, the more tolerant we become. That is the idea stated here. So, Padasevanam is closely related to the idea of universal humanism and in a way universal egalitarianism, we can say. It elevates devotion above the level of ritualistic practices and it elevates to the highest level of universal spiritual humanism. Because social humanism or scientific humanism or different schools of humanism, you can find right from the ancient pre-Christian Greek thinkers onwards, you find. But these humanistic philosophies had their limitations. But in spiritual humanism of devotional philosophy, you look upon not only human beings but entire creation as one spiritual family. That's why Sri Ramakrishna says, for devotees there is no distinction with regard to caste, nationality, race, language, customs or anything. Devotees of God belong to a class by themselves. It is a kind of universal spiritual humanism that Sri Ramakrishna is speaking about. The next one we are going to deal with Vandanam. So Sravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasim. Archanam we have already dealt with. I mean this Padasevanam and Archanam we have already dealt with. Now next one is Vandanam. Vandanam is a famous path, is a well-known path in the Navavidha Bhakti, and the classic example of Vandanam according to devotional tradition is Akrura. Akrura was a great devotee of the Lord who took Sri Krishna to Mathura, you know, and once he entered, he was asked by Kamsa to take Sri Krishna to Mathura from Gokula. And once Akrura entered there, he saw everywhere the presence of the Lord. So everything reminded him of the reality of God. So he bowed down before everything because he couldn't see anything other than the presence of the Lord everywhere. So it is Mandrocharana Dhyana Abhyam Manasa Vachasa Krama Shadangena Bhusparsham Tadvai Vandanam Uchyate. Externally we can define it this way. So this is the orthodox definition. One should chant the Rishi, Chanda, Devada, etc. And the mantra which is which has learned earlier, chanting this mantra, he should bow down before the Lord. And this japa can need not necessarily be verbal japa, externally visible. It could be mental japa. You know, japa is called chanting the name of God, has got various dimensions. When we hear something, when we are able to hear it with our ears, it is called vaikari. So there are four levels: para, paschanti, madhyama, vaikari. The highest is para and lowest is vaikari. At the highest level, the one who chants his mantras identify himself with the devata sankalpa, devata aspect of the mantra. He experiences the unity of the one who is practicing this mantra and also the deity whose sacred name he is uttering. That upasya, upasada, aikyam it is called. Unity between the spiritual practitioner and the supreme God, reality, whom he is meditating upon, chanting this mantra. This is para. And at the lowest level, the grossest level is vaikari, when the mantra can be heard. Depending upon the subtlety or grossness, the effect also can vary. When you chant a mantra with a sense of unity of your mind with the mantra ideal, the effect is maximum. When you chant it loudly, when it becomes more or less a vocal exercise, there is effect, but effect is the least. Between these two, there are two levels, paschanti and madhyama. So grossest is vaikari, next below that madhyama, where you try to chant the mantra with a perfect understanding of the meaning and an attempt to meditate upon the meaning of the mantra. That is madhyama. Paschanti is where you understand the meaning of the mantra and with perfect concentration you chant the mantra. So vandanam can be defined as going down to the Supreme God with all sincerity, earnestness and concentration. It could be just mental japa, manasam, which is subtle, or it may be vachikam, or it could be just verbal. Verbal is the least effective. Manasam or mental japa is most effective. So this is the vandanam ideal which is mentioned here. This is also an external ritual, but it also has got a transcendental dimension. It has got an empirical dimension and also transcendental dimension. For a beginner, external ritual is a must, and this is a very important, there is a very important reason for it. Normally, our senses are, as I said many times earlier, drawn towards external objects. These senses have to be drawn back from external objects. Now, we cannot forcibly withdraw our senses from external objects. Physically, we may be able to do that. If you close your eyes, you are externally withdrawn your sense of sight from external visual objects. But mentally you will be seeing those objects. So withdrawal here is only at the gross level. So it won't be effective. So great devotional philosophers have recommended a focus, an ideal, an internal ideal towards which you can focus these senses. We need a focus of concentration, focus of meditation, towards which these senses can be drawn. Mind is always growing, flowing towards the external objects. So the best we can do is to give a Godward orientation, a spiritual orientation to the normal function of the senses. For that we need an external object for a practitioner in spiritual life. So therefore, at the beginning, at the earlier levels of spiritual life, Vandanam has got a great significance, because Vandanam can easily help us in withdrawing the senses from external objects and draw them towards an internal spiritual ideal. And gradually, mind can be turned more and more towards God. That is the relevance of Vandanam as a spiritual exercise. Then we have got Dasya. There have been great spiritual personalities who have practiced this Dasya. In fact, one great example that's given in the devotional books is the example of Ambarisha himself. I already mentioned his name earlier. Ambarisha was a great king. It's a very interesting story. He was one day seated in his palace with full concentration, meditating on God. He was a real devotee. Now, a great sage came there. You know, sages and saints also belong to different levels. Durvasa was well known for his austerity, asceticism, and also short temper. So, one day when Ambarisha was immersed in meditation, this old ascetic came to his palace. The story has got another trapping, They say Durvasa was sent by somebody who wanted to shake Ambarisha's tapasya. That is another interpretation. Puranas are very fertile in this kind of mythological story. So I won't go to those details. Anyhow, Ambarisha was a great devotee, and one day he was merged in meditation on God. So the great sage Durvasa came there. And Ambarisha used to regularly practice this Ekadashi. So on the Dwadashi day, the next day, he should conclude his Ekadashi fasting in a very ritualistic manner. He should drink this Tulasi water or some of food offered to God, Ishtadevada. That's the tradition. So Ambarisha was getting ready for the ritualistic culmination of his fast, Dwadashi day morning. So this old ascetic came there. So it was the duty of a king to give food, all the offerings to a guest, that too a great sage like Durvasa. So he told him, please wait for some time. And I will take bath. Durvasa told the king, I will take bath and I will come. Then I will have my breakfast and food. So he went to the river, and deliberately the old man delayed. Because there's a particular time, it's called Muhurt, an auspicious time. At that time, Ambarisha was supposed to terminate his fasting ceremony. So he should take something, drink Tulasi water or something, fruits or something. So Durvasa deliberately delayed his return. Maybe he must have walked here and there in the river bank. He wanted to see that Ambarisha doesn't become too great, too spiritual. Anyhow, when he found the guest was delaying too much, Ambarisha thought, well, it's wrong for me not to terminate fast at this moment. At the same time, it is also wrong to have food when your guest, honorable guest, is away for his bath. It is his duty as a host to wait for the sage's return. It is his duty as a devotee to terminate his fast at the auspicious moment. So Ambarisha consulted his wise men in the court, and he came to a conclusion. He drank one drop of tulasi water. That means he has not taken food. So it won't be a dishonor to the guest who has come. Because if the host takes food, eats food, when the guest is away, it is a dishonor to the guest. So he didn't eat his regular food, he just drank one drop of tulasi water. So he has formally terminated his fast. At the same time, he had not taken formal breakfast. So when the sage returned, he found Ambarisha had already terminated his fast. Sage deliberately delayed and returned only after the auspicious moment was over. And he got terribly angry. In fact, that was his main profession, to get angry and to curse people, you can find. But very often, Durvasa was also well known to use his cursing power to help spiritual aspirants. Sometimes many stories are found in the Puranic literature. Anyhow, this time Durvasa was going to face a real problem that we'll find in course of time. So, when he found that King Ambarisha had already terminated his fast, he got angry, he cursed him. And what he did was, he took out one of his hairs and bounced on the ground, and a terrible demon came out. It's a mythological story, I remember. In fact, these stories as stories do not have much significance. But there is a great spiritual principle behind. In fact, that is the burden, that's the essence of the story, according to Vyasa himself, who is the compiler of all the Puranic literature. Vyasa did not expect us to take all these mythological stories in letter and spirit. He himself said the stories are meant to teach a central spiritual philosophy. There is a story behind the story that is important. So a demon was created by Durvasa, and this demon chased Ambarisha. Ambarisha was not bothered. As you know, as he said, you know, actually, Dukkeshu anidhikdamana, sukheshu vigadaspraha. You already find. He could face the pain and pleasure with an equanimity of mind. Yasmanna uddhijate loko, lokanna uddhijate chayaha. We already read about this in the 12th chapter. I already quoted this in the morning session. A real devotee is one who is not afraid of anyone. And nobody will have any reason to be afraid of him either, because he will be established in ahimsa and all these characteristics which are natural to a real devotee. So Ambarisha was not afraid. So this demon went to attack Ambarisha. But Ambarisha was such a great devotee that Lord Vishnu himself had promised that his Sudarsana Chakra, the divine weapon, will protect Ambarisha from all his enemies. So when the demon approached Ambarisha, the Sudarsana Chakra, the mighty weapon, also came out. And it destroyed the demon created by Durvasa. And then the Sudarsana Chakra chased Durvasa himself. So the old man ran about everywhere. First he went to Brahma. Brahma told him, I am totally helpless. I am myself depending upon Lord Vishnu for my protection. So what can I do to protect you? Anyway, you go to Shiva. And when Durvasa approached Shiva also, in fact, Durvasa was a devotee of Shiva. Shiva also perhaps wanted to teach his own disciple a good lesson. Well, I am also can't help you. I am not able to help you. You better go to Vishnu himself, because the weapon belongs to Vishnu. Durvasa went to Vishnu. Vishnu was more helpless. Vishnu, aham bhakta paradhinu. I am in the hands of my devotees. So Vishnu said, well, if you insult my devotees, I am myself helpless, because it is my duty to see that my devotees are not harmed by anyone. So if you really want protection from the Sudarsana Chakra, you better go and go to Ambarisha himself. And finally, the old ascetic Durvasa came to Ambarisha and fell under his feet, and then fell at his feet, and then Ambarisha told him, "You are great sage, why are you prostrating before me? Anyhow, I pray to Sudarshana, Lord Sudarshana Chakra, please spare this old ascetic, the old man." And then Sudarshana withdrew itself, and so and Durvasa was spared. This is the story behind. So according to Ambarisha, Dasya Bhakti is the easiest and most effective. Where Shuka himself gives the example of King Ambarisha as an ideal of Dasya Bhakti. He says, Savai Manakrishna Padaravindayoho Vachamsi Vaigunta Gunanu Varnani Karo Harer Mandira Marjanadishu Sudim Chagara Chudamatkathistali Bugundalingaya Darsane Drisho Dadbhaya Gatrasparsya Sangha Sangamam Kranamcha Tatpada Saroja Saurabhi Srimat Tulasaya Rasanam Tadarpide. It's a long description of Ambarisha. Ambarisha's spiritual practices are explained here. He had his mind always engaged in contemplation. Savai Manaha Krishna Padara Vintayohu Vajamsi Vaigunta Gunani Varnani. Mind was always engaged, steeped in the thought of God. And then Karo Harer Mandira Marjanadishu. So his mind and speech were always engaged in devotion. Mind was engaged in contemplation of Lord Krishna's feet, and his speech was always engaged in describing the Lord's excellences. And then Karo Harer Mandira Marjanadishu. His hands were always engaged in cleaning the temples of Hari, means service, because every human being is a temple of the Lord. So Ambarisha was supposed to be an ideal king. During his reign, all the subjects were happy and contented. The country was prosperous. Spiritual seekers were safe. See, there are long descriptions of Ambarisha's rule in the Purana literature. And Ambarisha's ears were always busy hearing the elevating narrative about God. And then he kept his eyes engaged in seeing temples. He says, so Mugunda Lingalaya Darsane Drishav. So his eyes were always engaged in seeing temples of God, means everywhere he saw only the presence of the Lord. So how a devotee reaches the highest ideal of spiritual experience, which is the same as the ideal of Advaitic experience. I already mentioned yesterday, when Shankaracharya himself describes the characteristics of Ananya Bhakti, the highest unwavering focused devotion, he equates this pure devotion with the highest jnanam itself. As Maicha Ananya Yogena Bhaktihi Abhibhicharini Vivikta Desha Sevittum Anabhirjana Samsati. So Ananya Yogena Bhajanam Bhaktihi, that is Shankaracharya's description. The highest devotion is the devotion where the devotee sees only God's presence everywhere. Whatever he does becomes an act of worship of God. Every thought becomes an act of meditation. Everything in this world becomes a manifestation of the divine. So in the 18th chapter of Gita, you find there you can say, you find God himself is the one who controls and regulates the entire creation. So, and Ambarisha's sense of touch in contacting the feet of his devotees. So everywhere he saw only the presence of the Lord. And his sense of smell in breathing the fragrance of tulasi leaves used for worship. Whole creation becomes a presence of the Lord. And again his tongue was always engaged in tasting the food offered to the Lord. With his feet, he went on pilgrimage to places where Sri Hari is worshipped. See what? See, every moment becomes an act of circumambulation. The ceremonial going round the temple, a place of worship. If the entire creation is a manifestation of the divine, then every moment becomes an act of circumambulation, going around, production of it, going around the sacred place. Because every place is sacred. And his one desire was to serve him wholeheartedly without desire. He had only one desire. That was the desire to serve God without desire. He lived in a way that would generate deep-seated love for the Lord and his devotees. His life itself was a great example for all devotees. And Ambarisha was an exponent of one great spiritual ideal in devotional philosophy. Tasmat kenapi upayena mana krishne niveshayet. So somehow, by some means or other, mind should be always devoted to God. We should be able to live mentally in a world of spiritual ideas, where we don't forget the presence of the Lord. Sri Ramakrishna gives a very graphic description of how a devotee should live in this world. That's also in a way a commentary on Ambarisha's philosophy. Sri Ramakrishna says, see, this world is like a river or an ocean. Now, when you travel in a boat, you should see that the water doesn't enter the boat. The boat should be on the surface of the water. But water should not enter the boat. So we can live in this world, but we should keep ourselves away from worldly mindedness or worldliness. One can live in this world without being worldly minded. Worldly mindedness is like the water and life is the boat. If the worldliness of water enters the boat, then the boat will capsize, life will be lost. Therefore, with one hand we should touch the feet of the Lord and with the other hand we should work. See, if you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you can find many sublime examples. Different types of devotees came to Sri Ramakrishna. Some of them were great intellectuals of those days, like Esa Chandrasen and so on. Some of them were agnostics. Swamiji himself, of course, at least many Brahma Samajis, you know. In the beginning, during his trial days, Swamiji was something like an agnostic. Though he was the highest adhikari for Advaita. Before he came to Sri Ramakrishna, though he was practicing devotion, sometimes he claimed to be an agnostic. Kesava Chandrasen, who was the Brahma Samaj leader, who was a great intellectual, never went to the temple of Divine Mother when he first came to the Dakshineswar. Because according to Brahma Samaj philosophy, you know, temple worship or image worship is not accepted. Brahma Samaj philosophy was highly influenced by the Unitarian Church, which was prominent in those days. So they rejected the highest Advaita on the one hand, and also the beginning of spiritual life, the image worship, the temple worship, also they rejected. So Keshavachandra Sen was not a believer in image worship when he first came to Sri Ramakrishna. But later, of course, you find when Sri Ramakrishna visited him, it was the end of Keshav's life, a few months before he went to Kamal Kutir, and at that time Keshav had already become a devotee of Divine Mother. He was himself calling upon the Divine Mother. It was the end of his life. So he was silently he was transformed from an agnostic to a regular devotee of God. Then there were atheists also. There were all types of people. They were extremely conservative, orthodox devotees. They were agnostics. They were atheists. They were also modern types of thinkers also. All were accepted by Sri Ramakrishna. And all of them got something from Sri Ramakrishna, depending upon their need and their aptitudes. Even a bohemian like Girishchandra Ghosh, who was certainly not a very desirable type of spiritual man during his early days, no going into details, he became a great devotee in course of time. So you find in the world of devotion, all have got access, depending upon their aptitudes and their behavior. But Sri Ramakrishna practiced one great principle while instructing his devotees. Depending upon their need and their own level of spiritual evolution, he gave them that much of devotion, that much of spirituality, which they will be able to practice, and that will take them to the next level of spiritual evolution. All got some practical help from Sri Ramakrishna. So, in a way, if you read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, you find different types of devotees who are practicing one or other of these nine paths of devotion, Navatha Bhakti. And there is a great statement by Kunti. Kunti is a great devotee in the Mahabharata tradition. Srunandi gayandi gnandi abhikshnasa smarandi nandandi tavekidam janaha ta eva pasyanti achirena tavakam bhavapravaho varamam padambujam. Kunti says, devotees who hear about the Lord, who sing glories of the Lord, who speak about God, who remember God and feel joy in remembering about God, they are able to remain, mentally they are able to remain in that spiritual level. So, one can practice all these paths together, or one can take one of these. So, Navadha Bhakti in a way is a compact, integrated philosophy of devotional life. There is nobody in the world who cannot take up one of these nine paths as a path leading to the ultimate spiritual goal. So now we will conclude, and the next session we will continue from where we are left today. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tatsat. Oh, please.
While meditating every day, in the beginning the mind wanders.
Yes.
And all the worldly thoughts come. Somebody has said this to me, that to me, and all that. But gradually my mind settles down. And the mantra is being chanted all the time. This has been happening. But as the God is in the transcendental field, this mantra is also one kind of a thought. So eventually, this thought also should go. If I have to have self-realization, how does this happen? people who have self-realized, they are in the transcendental field because the God is in the transcendental field. We can experience ourselves there only. I like to know this.
Yes, in fact, once you reach perfection in this saguna sakara meditation, spiritual practice, once you reach perfection, you will realize this identity between the upasaka and upasya, the practitioner, the one who meditates, and the object of meditation. It can never be logically analyzed. In fact, this identity is a matter of experience. Experienced only at the time of experience. At other times, you will feel you are living in this world. But this experience will have a transforming effect on you. Later on, you can never deviate from the higher level, higher experience. So, the Saguna Sakara meditation, spiritual practice, when it reaches the highest degree of perfection, will take you to the Nirguna Nirahara ideal. And again, according to bhakti tradition, you need not deliberately make an effort to reach the highest transcendental experience, because it is something which naturally comes to all great spiritual devotees. You need not practice any other sadhana to reach this level. At the highest experience level, this becomes a natural experience. That's what you find in the lives of great devotees. I hope it is clear.
Samju, one quick question. You know, we talked about the self-realized people are very calm, they do not have disturbances in mind, and all those things you talked about. But sometimes when I speak of Swami Vivekananda also, many of them, he got angry. And even he got angry with Swami. And when he was angry, even Swami was not in the good mood, dare to come near him. Yes. And then he said some strong words one time to Swami Brahmananda, who was weeping in his room. And then he, Vivekananda later on sent his brother Haribhai to check up. So sometimes I find that a little bit confusing. I mean, he's a realized soul, but he got so, I would say, emotional sometimes. It kind of baffles me.
Yes.
So could you please comment on
this? Yes. Now, when I spoke about the tranquility and equanimity of mind of spiritual persons, I was referring not only to those who reach the highest Advaitic experience, I was specially referring to the highest devotee. Dukkeshu aniddhukta mana sukheshu vigadaspar, the 12th chapter of Bhakti Yoga. Now, one point you have to remember is, see, an ordinary spiritual aspirant who reaches this experience may remain calm and quiet throughout his life and just lead his life and pass away. But there are great spiritual personalities who have a definite mission to fulfill in this world. They are liberated souls, the highest type. But they have to play certain roles in this world. Apparently, at least to a superficial observer, they may appear to be angry, they may appear to be disturbed and all that. But they are not disturbed. But to do certain work in this world as part of the spiritual mission for which they have come, they have to play this role. So, in the Vedantic tradition, there is a very graphic description of the difference between a baddha jiva and a mukta jiva. A highly liberated soul, a great liberated soul, and an ordinary bound soul. See, a king playing violin in his court as a hobby, and a professional violinist who is invited by the king to his court to play the violin. See, Rajnyaha Veena Vadanadivad, the Bhashya literature, not Shankara Bhashya, and other commentaries comes. You see, the description is this. Suppose a king invites a professional musician to his court. The musician has to be very careful. He should put away his best performance, because he may be expecting a reward. He may be even punished if his performance is not up to the expectations. So it's a matter of life and death for him. Now, suppose the king himself, one day, there's nobody, plays his violin for a hobby. The king is not at all affected. So the liberated soul, playing different roles in this world, for the good of the world, starting an organization like Ramakrishna Mission, doing philanthropical activities, giving a new interpretation to Vedantic philosophy, new Vedanta as it called. All these are different roles which Swamiji came to play in this world. That was the spiritual mission for which he came. So as part of this spiritual ministry, he had to correct people, he had to organize things, he had to work in this world just as apparently other ordinary human beings. But Swamiji always looked upon life in this world as a drama. See, a film actor playing the role of a beggar, he may get Oscar award and he may look more miserable in the film screen or on the stage if he's playing in drama. But he knows very well that after the makeup is removed, he will go and stay in a 5-star hotel. So the misery and wretchedness of playing the role of a beggar won't affect him. But what about a beggar begging the street? In his case, maybe he may look less miserable than the professional actor. So you find all the great spiritual personalities, incarnations, liberated Jivan Muktas, they have to play various roles for working out their spiritual ministry in this world. But they were never affected by any of them. It's like a film star playing the role of a beggar in the street. They were not affected by any of these things. But for ordinary jivas, whatever happens in this world deeply affects their life and personality. But Swamiji, Sri Ramakrishna, Shankaracharya, Buddha, all these great men, they were not at all affected by what they did or what they did not do in this world. Life was a stage for them, Shakespeare said. The whole world is a stage like that. That's the difference between a Baddha Jiva and a Mukta Jiva. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.